Welcome to Create Photography. This is Daniel Sig. In today's episode, we'll have another conversation with Daniel Milner. Daniel Milner is a journalist, photographer, and writer who is now performing these duties in his role as creative evangelist for Blurb. He has a blog called Shifter Media and lives in New Mexico. All right, Daniel, it is great to have you back on the podcast. How have you been?
I am doing just fine. I appreciate you having me on again. I enjoyed our last conversation, and I also enjoyed the book that you sent me, which I'm still slowly making my way through and in between other books. But
yeah, sure.
I have been, well, it's weird. I mean, I guess I'm not sure the last time exactly when we talked, but wow, we still have the pandemic we're dealing with, but things are busy now. They're busy in a different way than I haven't seen now for a couple of years. So I'm hoping we're trending in the right direction.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, I've been just kind of following your blog and some of the things you post on YouTube, and I can tell you've been very productive. So
Been good. I'm in the middle of really, I mean, something I jokingly call Operation Improve, where I'm trying to not only basically improve my skills in a variety of different things like graphic design and filmmaking, but I'm also going to completely rebuild my Shifter site and also hopefully rebuild the digital side of the AG23, the zine project I'm working on. So I've got a lot of work to do in the next few months.
Oh, cool. Oh, that's very super interesting. Well, I'm interested in that too. So before we go into the main topic for today, I want to quickly talk about something I read on your website also learned about you from your YouTube channel. That's journaling. I read and heard that you describe yourself as a compulsive journal keeper. And so I'm kind of curious about, I think first of all, it's very cool. I think it's fascinating. And I've seen some of your journals. They look very interesting. Can you just talk about this a little bit more?
Yeah. Journaling is, it's weird. When I was little, I mean like elementary school age, I had a little notebook. I actually still have a copy of one of these. I actually have the actual notebook. And what it was a little spiral bound notebook that my mother used to keep her grocery shopping lists. And I must have stolen it from her. And I just started to write short stories, like fictional short stories. And I also started to write down things like overheard dialogue from the adults around me, just random conversations. And I don't know what it was other than just a compulsion to record things. And so it started at that age. And then I sort of got away from it when I was in high school and pretty much in college. But when I graduated from school and I got an internship at the newspaper in Phoenix, the Arizona Republic, I was renting a room at another photographer's house. And she lived downtown and it was within walking distance of the Phoenix Public Library. And when I had those basically free moments, I would always go over to the library and look at the photography section. And one day I was walking through the library and I was not in the photography section. I don't remember what section I was in. And I looked down on the bottom shelf and there was a book that was kind of sticking out that somebody had partially pulled out and hadn't pushed all the way back in. And I thought, well, I should probably push that in all the way. And I bent down and started to push it in. And then the cover caught my eye. And it was a book called The Adventures and Misadventures of Peter Beard in Africa. And at that point in my life, I'd never heard of Peter Beard. I had no idea who he was or what he was. And I pulled this book out and it just blew my mind. And I was like, who is this guy? How do I not know about him? And that was the first moment of my sort of deep dive in life into Peter Beard. And Beard described himself as a diarist. And the journals were such a huge part of his work and his life. And it really put the bug in me. And I literally the next day went to like a grocery store, convenience store, and I bought a little cheap black and white composition notebook and a pen. And I just started to journal. And that was that was the summer of 1993. And I've basically journaled every day since then. And it's such an integral part of my life. I don't even really view it as journaling anymore. Mm-hmm. I just use that as a title. But it's such a, I mean, I was, before I came, I'm in a friend's house right now because he has internet. I don't have internet in my house. And so right before I left, I was journaling. Earlier today, I was on a blurb call for work and I was journaling. I was journaling this morning. Mm-hmm. It's just a default, it's an integral part of my life. And when I'm on the road and I'm traveling, I tend to journal even more. And what I journal ends up in the projects that I'm doing as really as an equal part these days to the photography. I actually copy and writing to me, basically the written word is I've always considered to be the high art. And it's, I have tremendous respect for people who can write professionally and write novels and news pieces and everything else. So it's just, I don't know, it's in my blood.
Mm-hmm. It is your, so the journaling, if I remember right, it has visual elements too though, right? So you're not just, it's not just writing. Is that correct?
Uh-huh.
Or, yeah. Okay.
I use, it's funny you mentioned that. My print, I've had the world's worst, like it's probably 12 years old, this like all-in-one desktop printer scanner. It's a Canon. It finally broke. And so I've, everything I'm photographing in the field or drawings I'm doing, I'm a terrible artist, but I occasionally will make drawings. I'll do notes and I'm printing things out all the time and gluing them into the journal. And I also have one of those little printers that my friend Brandon at Fuji gave me, this sort of an older version, but it's a little printer that prints the Instax. So I can take images with the phone and fire them over to the printer. And they're really nice. And I also do a lot of letter writing. I write tons of letters. And so I'm always including those images in letters that I'm sending to people as well. So yeah, the visuals are part of it, but to me, it's not, my journals are not picture books. I know folks who make journals that are 99% photography, and that's not what I'm doing. The word I would say is probably 80%, and the visuals are 20%.
Hmm. Very cool. So, well, the printing that you just mentioned is the perfect lead in to the main topic. So, and I didn't even plan it that way, but So what I'd like to talk about and dive a little bit deeper on is the topic of printing, printing photography books, et cetera, signs and so forth. I think the motivation here is part educational, part inspirational. You know, there are terms like, you know, perfect binding, bleed, spread that, you know, may be foreign to many of us who are not in the field. And so I guess before we go in to those types of details, I was just going to ask you if we could talk about, you could talk about the entire process of, you know, maybe printing and with maybe some practical aspects, tips and tricks along the way. And, you know, we can break it down eventually a little bit more. But so I want to kind of just do it. Let's just assume a case study or a scenario where, you know, we have a small project, you know, that's small body of work that maybe we want to print in a zine or in a, you know, could be a bunch of postcards in a box or something like that. And I just want to, you know, maybe that's not the postcards in the boxes may not be the perfect example. So let's just assume it's really a printed book, but would you mind just kind of sharing how you see the creative process and then kind of walk us through that process?
I would break it into thirds. I think the first decision that you have to make if you're going to start, and printing an individual print and printing a book are two very different things. And I think the individual print is what I would refer to as a gateway drug towards printing something like a zine or a book or a magazine, because making a single image is in many ways far easier than printing something with a narrative. And I think it's a really good exercise. In fact, that's why I love those little Instax printers. I love inexpensive inkjet printers you can get at home. You don't need to make anything fancy. And the idea is you make a decision that you're gonna work in narrative form or make a picture story or a picture essay instead of just random pictures. You're trying to tell a story. And I think that changes the dynamic of how you work in the field. It changes the dynamic of the kind of photograph you have to make, because you're not just shooting 10 great images, that would be considered a portfolio. When you're telling a story, mm-hmm. you're telling pictures, you're making pictures that tell the story and help with the narrative, which means you have to often make a style of picture to combine with the really beautiful portfolio style pictures. And so it makes you think in a different way. The second part of that is when you come to making a publication or printing a magazine or a book, you have to edit. And editing is an art form, and it's a huge part of the process of bookmaking is really understanding how to edit. The best image from your project may not end up on the cover of the book. That may not be the picture that's the best picture to tell or sell the story of your book. And then secondarily, the sequence of those images. So number one is you made a decision to shoot in the field in narrative form. That's a big one. Then when you're back, you have to edit for publication, sequence for publication, and then you start to begin to design. And page design or graphic design is a separate art form. And then you throw in on top of that things like typography. And here's where the complexity of bookmaking begins. And I think for those out there who've never done this before, it can seem daunting because I haven't even gotten to like the software that you would use to design, whether you're going to use something like Blur Book Write or Adobe InDesign or some other application, Lightroom, for example. All of these things combine, and all of a sudden you begin to realize that bookmaking includes a lot of skills. And I think it's why it intimidates a lot of younger photographers or inexperienced photographers or people who spend a lot of time online or in the digital space, because they look and they're just like, wow, I've never done this before. Number one, number two, I don't know about software. I don't know about typography. I don't know page design. That is entirely okay. And the beauty of bookmaking today is that you can make something really cool for less than $3. You'll actually pay more for shipping than you will for a $3, 20 page or 24 page sample book for $3. Zines are incredibly lo-fi. They've historically been inexpensive, approachable, very democratic. And the thing is, bookmaking and printmaking is an acquired skill and it takes practice. So if you're new to it, it's just about making something upfront. Just commit to something, make it, doesn't have to be fancy, doesn't have to be expensive, doesn't have to be perfect. You just make it and you learn from your mistakes. And that first publication more than likely will have 2, 3, 4 things that you look at and say, I can't believe I did that. That's not the right typeface. That border's too small on the images. My color's not quite right. All of those things that are natural growing pains for anyone who's making a publication, that shouldn't be stressful. That's the fun. That's the hunt of saying, I'm going to get better as a bookmaker. And printing is very important. And for those folks out there who think that because we're living in the digital age, print doesn't have relevancy, that could not be further from the truth, especially the higher up you go in the industry. So the higher up you go in photography, art, design, illustration, the more respected print is. And for a photographer, a professional photographer, getting a book deal is still one of the most important aspects of your career. At the higher levels, it means a heck of a lot more than how many Instagram followers you have. It's a huge separator from sort of the online photography world and the actual industry of photography. So print is a language that's comprised of dozens and dozens of dialects, and it just takes practice and patience to learn them. And, for me, when I got into photography, I was trained by my educational institution to believe that a book had to be a certain thing. And it wasn't until about 2007 where I kind of had this realization that was not what I wanted. I didn't want a book like that. I don't want a coffee table book that's expensive and big and precious and heavy. I wanted something approachable that would be that an everyday person off the street who has no relationship to photography would still be interested in looking at what I was producing. And so it made me shift my mindset about what printing was and how to do it for a wide audience. So there's a lot to learn, but if you've never done it, you just start and learn by your mistakes.
Mm-hmm. Great. That's an awesome overview. And so I took some notes. So I had some questions before and I kind of sorted them under those three, under these thirds, so to say. So we have number one, narrative story, number two, editing, how to edit and sequence, and number three, design, page design, graphic design, typography, etc. So let's start briefly with the narrative story. I think super important, right? Any thought, you know, I know that's a big topic in and of itself, but maybe just, you know, what are your thoughts around that? How do we, even for that, right? If we let, maybe we have something in mind, but maybe we haven't photographed it yet, or, you know, how, if we already have a vision to have something in a book or zine format, can you talk about that? And maybe,
shooting in narrative form is, for some reason, and I think this dates back probably to what we were talking about earlier about my urgent need to record from anything from the time I was a kid. I never shot singles, I think is kind of referred to, at least in the photojournalism world, or like single images. When I was working for the newspaper, obviously singles were something you had to do on a daily basis. Oftentimes, every assignment you shot, for the most part, had to be summed up in a single frame. And newspaper photography was the ultimate training ground, because the range of assignment you could get in a single day was just astounding. You had to be prepared for anything, and you had to summarize the entire story in a single image. And if you were lucky, occasionally they would throw you a bone and they may run like 2, 3, 4 images, or what's called a picture package, from a story, but that was pretty rare. And then even more rare was occasionally a photographer would get cut loose and would be taken off of daily assignments, and they would be allowed to work on a long-term project for like months and months at a time. And I remember the paper that I was at, there was the competing paper, which was owned by the same company, and we all worked out of the same darkroom. So two papers working out of the same darkroom, but with like probably 40 photographers. And there was a guy named Mark Henley, and Mark Henley, who's a great photographer, a cool guy, he was taken sort of off the daily assignments. And he was given this permission to work on something called the Navajo Project. And that ended up, I think, I want to say that got nominated for a Pulitzer, but I don't think they won. But anyway, working in narrative form makes you think very differently, because you have to put yourself in the mindset of the viewer and say, what is my story? What is my narrative? What is the arc? And then what are the images that comprise this? And I think to simplify it, and I hate to do this because it's not a formula. So I think if you look at modern travel magazines, oftentimes their stories are formulaic, especially if, let's say that they do, someone's doing a project on Lisbon, the city of Lisbon, and they'll be like, okay, we need a portrait, we need a detail, we need a food shot, we need a night shot, we need a cityscape, you know, the same formulaic stuff that we've seen 1,000 times, and people do it really well, but it's boring. And so I don't want to ever pigeonhole people into thinking they have to do that. In photojournalism, you'll hear a similar story of like scene setter, portrait, you know, whatever, environmental. It's not, it doesn't have to be that formulaic. But what you often have to do is that we are all on the hunt for signature images that identify us as photographers. So if you walk into a gallery and you see images on the wall and you look at them, and I have worked hard enough in my life to develop a signature style, you from across the room can look at that gallery show without reading the title or the captions and say, I know who made these pictures. Those are Dan Milner pictures. Now that's sort of the ultimate goal. But inside of a story, you can't just have those photographs. You have to have what I always consider to be transitional images that link one section of a story to the next that may not be aesthetically beautiful, but they give the reader information to link them to the next section of the story. That could be a landscape. That could be a detail. That could be a portrait of someone. And that's how stories are built. So it's a very different thing from building a portfolio or trying to make a single image on Instagram that gets a ton of views. You've got to tell a story, and that takes practice. And it almost is like you're mastering self-control in some weird way, because you got to take your foot off the gas from time to time and shoot something that you look at and say, that's not sexy. It's not sexy at all, but I need to do this. And I'll give you an example. I have a project that I had done years ago in Sicily. And one of the images that I lead with in that, it's not the image that's on the cover, of the book, but it's the first image inside, and it's a picture. It's a landscape. It's a black and white landscape photo. And I am by no means a landscape photographer at all, but it's a landscape photograph that shows a little village on a hilltop. And if you look at that, you realize immediately you're not in the United States. And Sicily, they built towns on hilltops because they were invaded by so many different armies, and they built cities on hilltops so they could see who was coming. And so it immediately identifies that you are not in the United States. Plus, we don't have architecture like is in this photograph.
Right.
And it takes you to a setting. Then I start to hit you with the images that I think are signature of my work. And then you bounce from like complex, layered, wide angle images to portraiture. And then I begin to tell the story. And so that's sort of it. It's not the cover image, but it's the cover image is simple. It's graphic. It's an easy read. And the cover image is an image that people say, what am I looking at? What is this? And that's the hook. Mm-hmm. I'm getting people to stop what they're doing and give me 1 second of undivided attention. And that's what the cover image is designed for. Then when they crack that book, they see the landscape that gives them a sense of place. And then the next image is my signature style. And I want them to look at that third image and say, wow, like that image makes me really stop. Who is this photographer? What is this story? That's how narrative photography works.
Mm-hmm. So I'm curious for filmmaking, right? Sometimes people talk about storyboarding, kind of like just that concept of, you know, creating basically a storyboard of the different scenes, kind of visualizing what might happen. Is that something which is, does that even make sense for photography, for photographic narrative storytelling?
I've never done storyboarding for still photography. I've tried to do storyboarding for filmmaking. I suck so bad at filmmaking because I'm sort of new to it. And I'm like today, I made three entire films today alone. I scripted them, recorded them, edited them, uploaded them, and I just finished before you and I started talking. And so when you're making that many films in that short amount of time, I don't have high expectations for making anything with great production value. My films ride right now on information that I'm delivering. I think that's the only thing I have going for me. I think with still photography, I don't storyboard, but I research. And then the trouble I think with storyboarding for stills is that you can back yourself into a corner because when you get in the field, it often does not resemble what you had in mind. Mm-hmm. And I learned that from older, wiser photographers when I was a newspaper photographer. And you'd go into the paper in the morning and there'd be a basket with your name on it with a stack of assignments. And you'd pick these assignments up, look at the timeline of where you had to be at what time, and then the subject. And oftentimes, if you had enough time or too much time, you'd start pre-visualizing what you were going to see. And 99.9% of the time, it was not remotely like what you had preconceived. Yep. And that can throw you off because you get out there envisioning of what you're going to see. And then you get there and you go, oh, God, it's a guy and it's a city councilman in a windowless room in front of a laptop with fluorescent lighting. And you go, God, this is horrible. Like what? And now you're like kind of ticked off and you're depressed because this is a crap picture. It should never have been assigned. And so you have to react to what's in front of you. Mm-hmm. And I think the simplest thing is you're constantly looking for light and timing, and then composition thirdly is what you're trying to put your stamp on it. But I don't storyboard. I would envision if I am going to continue making films and my films have any chance of getting better, then I would possibly start storyboarding. Mm-hmm. But most of the time I'm working so fast. I mean, I'm going to release a film tomorrow. That's not a particularly good film. It's called Everyday Expedition. And I probably did the entire amount of time in the field was probably 2 hours. So I had about an hour of like before sunset on one day and about an hour to an hour and a half the next morning at sunrise. And it was like a fire drill. I was recording audio and shooting stills and doing motion and doing phone and three cameras and everything else. And it just feels like I'm completely out of control. So there's no why I would try to storyboard that. I don't know. Right. Maybe it would be helpful, but most of the time, and then I get back to the van and I'm just like, what happened? What just happened? And I come home and try to make sense of it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, cool. All right. So that was a lot of great information about the narrative stories of our first third of the process. Let's move to edit. I have kind of one question here that I want to focus on, and that's really processing our photographs for print before mm-hmm. we even start editing, which maybe can fall under this, right, under this process as well. Can you talk a little bit about that? Because I think that's something that I think new photographers or photographers who are not experienced in printing may struggle with as well.
So processing your files, I have two schools of thought on this.
Okay.
And I'll tell you my workflow, which is not going to take long at all. So I prefer to shoot film, but I rarely shoot film anymore because logistically it just doesn't work for the demands that I have on me. I don't have time to ship film. So I'm primarily shooting digital files. I have two presets inside of my Lightroom program. One is a color preset called Kodacolor Gold, I think. And the other one is a black and white preset. I have probably had these, and these are the only two presets I have total. And the only two presets I've had, I think, for at least a decade. So if I have a color image, I apply the Kodacolor Gold preset. And if it's a black and white image, I apply this other black and white preset and I export. That is the grand extent of work that I do to my files. So I think file manipulation is a fine line between just right and way too much. And mm-hmm. so a lot of the work I see today that's produced and manipulated is really far beyond anything that you would want to try to print. So I would be very cautious about how much manipulation you actually do. But the primary goal here with image processing for print is your color fidelity and your density. And I think one of the, probably the single most common mistake that people make is they sit in front of a monitor with the brightness turned all the way up and they look at their monitor and they go, wow, these pictures look amazing. And they send those off to print and they come back dark. And that is because there is no printer on earth that can push that much ink and that much light through these files. How images look on monitors and how they print are two very different things. So keep your monitor density in mind. And if you're looking for color fidelity, just calibrate your monitor. Beyond mm-hmm. that, it doesn't matter because the general public, when they look at a book of photography, are not looking at color fidelity. They don't care. They really don't care. The public needs to be one, entertained, or two, educated. They are looking for something that is going to get their undivided attention. So yes, color is important to a degree, but I have never had a member of the public pick up one of my books and hold it up to the window light and get their head 3 inches away from the paper and say, oh, this print is 10 points magenta and it should have been more. They don't look at it like that. They're either going to engage with your project or they're not. And so I think a lot of photographers, especially consumers and prosumer levels, who are very keen on technical aspects of photography often get lost in the bookmaking process because they go down the rabbit hole of color management. And for me personally, color management is one of the most boring topics I have ever encountered in my life. I was bored with it in 1997 when I took my first week-long color management workshop when I worked for Kodak Professional. And I was stuck in the basement of a hotel on Sunset Boulevard. And I wanted to be anywhere on the earth besides that room. Because within the first half day of this class, I wanted to quit Kodak and never go back again. I thought to myself, this is the most boring topic ever. So once you have the basic ingredients there, then you concentrate on story and on your page design. You're editing your sequence and your page design because the color should only be a small piece of the conversation.
Mm-hmm. So speaking of sequencing, which, you know, in some ways we can say is still under the editing, I guess, right? Yeah. You mentioned a few things already in the narrative, and is it kind of like when we're thinking about, again, I'm going back to movie making, filmmaking, where you have, or even story writing, right? The story arc and arch and stuff like that. Is that how you think about it too, in some ways, for a photographic narrative?
Yes. Okay. It's the sequencing is the what I would say is the forgotten piece of bookmaking that can come back and bite you very quickly if you don't have the right sequence. So editing can be terrifying to people, especially in the digital age. And one of the things that I've been hearing teaching workshops for, I don't know, years now, I typically teach once or twice a year. And when digital arrived, students sometimes, you know, we'd go out in the morning and shoot somewhere and they'll shoot 20 gigs worth of files in one morning. And I'm like, that is just pure crazy because no one can edit that much. There's no reason to shoot that much. Right. And so editing down, if you shoot 1,000 images and edit to 500, that's not editing. Editing is saying, what are my top 20 images? What are the top 10? What are the top five? And what is the single best image from the shoot? And then what is the single most important image from the shoot? And then potentially you use that as sort of the top of your pyramid and you build around it. Sequencing is the order in which those images appear in a book. And this is an art form. This rarely gets spoken about. Editing gets spoken about a little bit. Used to be a lot more than it is now. But editing people, you know, even the like consumer level folks will say, oh yeah, I know it's important to edit. Sequencing is a whole different thing. A single image out of sequence can crush your entire project. And I've had that happen to me personally. One image placed wrong, too close to the front of the book, an editor not paying attention, an editor not reading what that she should have been reading, sees that image, is offended by it, slams the portfolio in my face and says, I refuse to look at this and walks away. Now, you can say, yes, her fault, not paying attention. And that's true. But I looked at it and said, that's my bad. Because I put this picture, which I thought was a picture that defined me as a photographer, and it made me excited. And I thought, oh, I'm going to put this right up front because this shows how good I am as a photographer. That was a bad move because the subject matter interpreted by an American blew up in my face. And I should have had that picture later on after I had sort of set the table for what that picture and that content was going to be. And so that was a single picture out of place, crushed the whole thing. So sequencing is critical. And I always equate it to a roller coaster. And maybe, I don't know, that's juvenile, but the roller coaster, and I don't like roller coasters. I never have. When I was a little kid, my family still makes jokes about me and my father. We were both terrified of roller coasters and we would go on like the kiddie roller coasters and we'd still be terrified. But the roller coaster builds you up. And the thing is, before you get on it, you know what you're in for the most part. And yet they still terrorize you by agonizingly pulling you up that slope and the click, 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 click of the cars. And you're like, God, why on earth did I do this? I knew I wasn't going to like this. And then bam, they drop it on you. And I think that's what a good movie does. That's what a good novel does. That's what a good photo essay does. And that can be done like a blunt instrument, or that can be done with razor fine, subtle precision where you don't know you're being manipulated, but you are. And I think photography photo essays are a psychology experiment of manipulation by the editor, the designer, the photographer saying, we are going to take you on a ride and you're actually, as a viewer, you're not in control. We are. And we're taking you here. And that's the real fun part. And you don't always win. Sometimes you make, like I did, made a wrong move. The thing crashed and I had to start over. And so, yeah, editing and sequencing is a, you know, there used to be, when I went to school, photo school, we had classes on editing, you know, where you just basically just re-edited stuff you'd already shot. And I think that died a long time ago. I think digital unleashed a deluge of volume of imagery that just no one saw coming. And I see a lot of like very sloppily edited stuff today, especially things that I see presented digitally. I'm amazed. I was so excited a few weeks ago. I saw a single image from a photo essay online and I was like, oh man, I really want to look at this. And it was just so poorly edited and designed and delivered. It was an absolute and utter turnoff. And I just kind of was like, ugh, because remember back when everyone was like, oh, the internet is going to solve every photographer's problem. You know, it's going to be the ultimate delivery mechanism for photo essays and stuff. It's not, it never has been. And it's just compared to like print form and book form, it's just lagging so far behind. Volume wise, doing fine. But boy, when you're looking at, you're attempting to look at a photo essay and you are seeing more advertisements than actual imagery, you know that ship has kind of sailed.
Right.
And so, yeah.
Right.
What I like to do, and I think is a good test and good starting point for people, is take something like a MagCloud Digest, which is minimum page count on a MagCloud Digest is 8 pages. That's pretty small. And it's also, I think, $1.20 for a MagCloud Digest. And just put borders on yourself. Just say, look, I'm going to do an 8-page digest, and that's it. That's all the real estate I have to work with. And I'm going to make the best 8-page digest I possibly can. That's a fun exercise. Instead of saying, oh, I can do 200 pages. Well, designing 200 pages, even for a professional designer, that's not easy. And so for a novice bookmaker, 8 is just fine. And you're not going to break the bank.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's cool. So, yeah. And so we're kind of, that leads us into, right, the design. So the next, our third topic, the third. So I think that's an area where there's a lot of, you know, there are a lot of terms, right? And binding and the spread and the bleed and, you know, those types of terms that if we don't understand them, they're certainly confusing. So is there, what's a good way to start? I mean, you already mentioned, you know, we could go do a MagCloud project, a small one, but, you know, even within that project, are there, what's the decision process? What, you know, what should we look at? Even, you know, things like I did one podcast where I just talked about aspect ratios, you know, something that we don't talk about a lot, but I think it's actually quite important as well. You know, to kind of think about that maybe ahead of time, especially digital now, we can even set it or we can compose to certain aspect ratios, right? Stuff like that. Maybe too technical, I don't know, but I'm just curious about, you know, those types of things as well, if that, how we should think about that, or should we not think about it and just kind of go with a certain aspect ratio, for example, and see how we can design it in a certain format.
Well, I think when it comes to design, graphic design, realize it's an entirely separate discipline, and the people who do it professionally full-time are scary good. They're very talented. So for example, when we started our zine project called AG23, my collaboration partner, I was actually trying to convince him not to do it. And I thought if I explained to him all the expenses we would have, he would just go away. And he didn't. And he's a very ardent guy who was like, I'm not going anywhere. This is a good project. We should do it. And I said, well, the first thing we have to do is hire a designer. And I want to get Zoe Sadakirsky out of Sydney to do the design, because she is so much better than either of us will ever be. And I knew that if we were going to take the work from other creatives, we had to consider the design at the same level or more than the actual work we were putting into the zine. And I knew that Zoe would take it and turn it into something beautiful. And that's exactly what she did. And I think one of the easiest things to do is to look at photography books. Mm-hmm. And you don't have to go in person to do that, even though if you live in a place like Santa Fe, we've got Photo Eye. If you live in Santa Monica, you've got Hennessy and Ingalls, things like that. You've got Kinokuniya in Sydney and great bookstores all over the world. But we live in the COVID age at the moment. So looking online at photography books, there's a couple, 3-volume series by Martin Parr and Jerry Badger called History of the Photo Book, Volume 1, 2, and 3. And that is an encyclopedia of graphic design and good photography books. And so this is a language, and you need to look and expose yourself to what is good, because these books that are featured in these volumes, they're there for a reason. And there is nothing accidental about photography books. So things like image size, border size, bleeds, text placement, text density, typefaces, everything is completely and utterly mapped out. There's no accidents. It's not like the book designer said, well, I used Futura typeface because it was just the first thing in the default menu. No, they don't do that. Everything is thought out. And so it's a really wonderful way to expose yourself to the level of skill involved in high-level bookmaking. The second thing you can do, and I just did this myself, is I checked out a book on graphic design from the library. And it's terrifying. Because it just, within 10 pages, I was like, I don't know any of this. You know, I have a degree in photojournalism. We literally had one class on design which was done with a T-square and tracing paper. None of us had computers, and that was it. And my design experience in college was designing a book cover for Last of the Mohicans. That was it. And everybody in the class had to do the same thing. Everyone was like, okay, design with T-square, tracing paper, and press on type, design the Last of the Mohicans. Now, I think my design was actually pretty good looking back on it, but it was agonizing. It took like 3 months to put this thing together. And so I didn't learn a whole heck of a lot about design. And I know that it's a weakness for me. And so if it's a weakness for me, chances are it's a weakness for somebody else. That's perfectly okay. Mm-hmm. But what I do is I try to make the best possible photography I can as a starting point. And that takes enormous amounts of time, luck, resources, patience, persistence. And then once you've got a body of work, then you're at that's the top of the pyramid. And now you're working down. But as you go down the pyramid, the base of knowledge expands. And so it can be daunting, but again, I always encourage people, don't be intimidated by this. Mm-hmm. Just understand and enjoy the mistakes that you make, learn from them and move on. And if you're making something like an 8-page MagCloud Digest and you're spending $1.20 and you make 5 mistakes, you go, who cares? I spent a buck 20, you know, I'll learn and I'll never make those mistakes again. But that's how it happens. It's not just, you know, instant. I think one of the things that I run into a lot is new bookmakers who will say things like, well, I need to make sure this is perfect. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, I don't know what that is. Like what, I think if you, like, I was amazed. Blurb years ago, we were able, fortunately, to work with a guy named Chris Boot. And Chris Boot did an edit on a project that was a collaboration between Blurb and a photographer. And I'd been around photography by that point for probably like 20 or 25 years. And I'd been editing my own work and editing other people's work from time to time. But the edit that Chris Boot did was so good. It floored me. I was like, God, I never saw it. I never could have done what he did. And even for me, with that much time in photography, I was just, you know, it kind of like put me back in my place. Like, oof. There are people out there at a level that are so far beyond me. And so I got a lot of work to do. And I didn't look at that as intimidating. I looked at it as encouraging. Like, man, I've got a lot of runway in front of me that I still haven't experienced yet. And I think that's really the encouraging part is like, look, we all have runway in front of us still. So just be patient and you'll get there. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's great advice. And so speaking of advice, what are some of the resources you would, you know, recommend if somebody wants to, you know, get into this and maybe do, you know, start with a small MagCloud Digest or something like that? I mean, of course, you can just go ahead and do it, right? But maybe people want to learn a little bit more about all this, about design, about sequencing. Are there any particular resources other than, you know, you mentioned the book series as one? Is there anything on YouTube you can recommend? I mean, I certainly recommend people to our listeners to listen to you on YouTube. Talk about sometimes about this as well. But are there other resources you could recommend, I guess?
You know, there's two things. There's a friend of mine who I haven't talked to in a while, and he's on YouTube, and I want to say his name is Aaron Hardin. AaronHardin. And I don't know what his channel is. And I don't think Aaron makes a lot of YouTube films. And I wouldn't say that he has any kind of sizable following, but he's very talented. He's an educator. He's a photography educator. And he talks about editing and sequencing photo books. I've heard that, who's the Magnum guy, Little Brown Mushroom, Alex Soth. I've heard that Alex Soth has an amazing YouTube channel. Mm-hmm. I have not yet seen it. And that's only because I'm so swamped. I don't really look at a lot of YouTube stuff. And then when I do, it's always like, you know, some 100-year-old woman shooting a machine gun or some ridiculous thing that I get sucked into for no apparent reason. And then I feel horrible afterwards. And it's like eating fast food and you go, why did I do that?
Why did I do that? Yeah.
The other thing too is, again, if you go to photoeye.com, which is a bookstore, illustrated bookstore here in Santa Fe, considered by many and arguably the best photo bookstore in America. And PhotoEye has a range of book that is staggering, from like the classic oversized coffee table book. Someone sent me an image today about Matt Black's book, American Geography. And another photographer wrote me and said, have you seen this? And I said, no, but I've been aware of his work for many, many years. And they said, this book is good, like really good. And here's my suggestion is, let's say that you take the Matt Black book, American Geography, and you look at that book and it resonates. You get out a pen and a piece of paper and you write down why it resonates. What is it? Is it the photograph? And then why do those photographs resonate? And then start looking for patterns inside the book of spreads that resonate, because the spreads are often a combination of image, white space, typography, and placement. And then you start to work backwards as to why does this spread resonate with me? Is it just the photograph, or is it a combination of these pieces? And is there a consistency to the spreads that make an impact with me?
Can you quickly explain the spread, what a spread is actually?
A spread is like a two-page spread. So when you open the book and you've got a left-hand page and a right-hand page, and oftentimes you'll have elements that cross the gutter. Sometimes photography books will have a lot of pages where nothing crosses the gutter, where you'll have an image on one page or the other, or both, type that's in two column or three column. You may have captions, you may have page numbers, you may have what's called type hierarchy, meaning that specific elements of the type will be in specific typefaces, sizes, and densities. And once your brain sees the first spread, your brain will immediately identify each of those different type treatments to have different meaning. Mm-hmm. So for example, if the caption of an image is in bold 14-point type and the body of the story is in 12.2 column, the next time you turn a spread, when your eyes see those ingredients, it immediately identifies one as the caption and one as the body mm-hmm. copy. Mm-hmm. And so those are consistent throughout a book, but you're looking at the elements of these books and saying, why does this resonate? And then mm-hmm. you're basically co-opting those techniques and creating your own books. And so I love fashion magazines from the 1980s in terms of page design and graphic design, because fashion in the 80s had money. You know, fashion mm-hmm. in the 90s actually had money too. The 80s and 90s was the age of the supermodel. You had Marie Claire and Elle and Vanity Fair and all these magazines that had unbelievable budgets, and they had the best photographers, the best graphic designers, and the best editors. And they produced remarkable stuff. In many ways, even though I was a photojournalism major, I found more interesting work in fashion than I did in my own industry. You know, my own industry was pretty safe, pretty conservative. And all of a sudden fashion did things with typography that I was like, oh my God, you're kidding me. You know, you look at a book like Cyclops by Albert Watson and you just go, Jesus, this is everything I was told never to do. And yet it works. And oh, by the way, he's an incredible photographer. And so I look at, I'm trying to remember the guy's name. I can never remember him. He's a graphic designer that worked in fashion in the 80s and did this amazing type treatments. But I'm constantly scouring those old magazines for techniques that I look at and think this might work for something I'm doing now. And that's fine. I think, you know, copying someone directly is never cool, mm-hmm. but acknowledging the fact that you're influenced by someone. I mean, there are plenty of photographers out there who influenced me. Right. I would never copy them, but if someone asks, I'll say, absolutely, I was influenced by whoever, you know, right. Maggie Stieber right. or Susan Mizellis or Catherine Loire, or Mary Ellen Mark or anyone like that. You're like, absolutely. This, you know, story is done in the tradition of, and you tip your hat to the people that came before you.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Awesome. Well, awesome. Well, I think we covered a lot of ground. I think that was really great, because we got through, you know, kind of those two thirds of the narrative story, the editing and sequencing, and also sure. a lot of design, and also some hopefully practical examples on how we could start with such a project, with the Mac Cloud Digest as one example, and obviously seeking inspiration from older magazines or from, you know, some of the resources, and we'll link to some of the resources in the show notes as well. And yeah, so Daniel, I think I just want to thank you again. I think it was a lot of fun, learned a lot, and I hope our listeners will think the same. And thanks again.
Of course. Thanks for having me. I love talking about this stuff. It's basically endless. There's always someone coming along new. Every generation, there's a handful of people that just reinvent the wheel in a very fun and unique way. And so even if you think you know what you're doing, there's someone coming along that's going to hit the reset button for you. And that's exciting. So I appreciate you having me. I love doing this.
All right. Thanks again.
Absolutely. Thank you.